You're like, what? Are you going to give out free candy or something? No. Tonight is the night where there is romance. Are you excited about that? Like, oh, no, that's the last thing. Some of you are like, oh, romance, gross. We don't do romance. Well, romance, kind of. This is going to be kind of an unusual short romance and unusually entered into and unusually walked through. But nonetheless, I think we could say that that indeed is what's going to happen. There's going to be love and not marriage yet, but love in the very real sense of the word, a commitment made for the benefit and blessing of another. So it's going to be very unusual. Again, it's a very unusual night, and you're going to have to put on your, a young adult and an adult thinking, because, I mean, there's very adult things happening here, just even as far as the situation goes. And maybe many of you have thought about what it might like to one day make a marriage proposal, and you've probably not thought about this. All right, so and actually I'm going to encourage you, don't think about this when it comes to your engagement proposal. But anyway, what are you talking about? What am I talking about? Well, Ruth chapter 3, read it with me. I was saying don't read out loud with me, but read along with me. Follow along, be focused here, because this text is absolutely fascinating. I got to read all 18 verses because it all fits together, so stay with me. Sometimes when I'm reading a long time, you just zone, I know, but all of this is important. So open up your Bibles to Ruth chapter 3. You need to see that this is there. I'm not making this up, and we're going to talk about all of this, at least at some level. So Ruth chapter 3, this is, by the way, stage 3, or it is phase 3 of the author's plan to move us from really sin and bitterness to hope and provision, and now to full, or one stage before, one step closer to full redemption. We're not there yet, that's chapter 4, but this is stage 3 of God's plan to make provision for Naomi, for Ruth, and for you, for the entire world in the salvation that comes through Jesus. So Ruth chapter 3, then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, shall I not seek security for you that it may be well with you?" Remember that Ruth has been working in the field of Boaz for 6 to 7 weeks and nothing has happened. She just goes to the field, she brings back the grain, and there is no redemption, there is no redeemer, she's working. She's working for her mother-in-law. She goes back and sit in the house, and they enjoy their food together, and they go to bed at night, and they blow out the candle, and she gets up and does it the next morning. Now the barley harvest is over. What's going to happen? Right, it's all the finished harvest. She's not going to have a field to go to. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, shall I not seek security for you that it may be well with you? Now is not Boaz our kinsman with whose maid you were? Behold, he winnows barley at the threshing floor tonight. Wash yourself, therefore, anoint yourself, and put on your best clothes. Go down to the threshing floor, but do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking." Wow. All right. "It shall be that when he lies down, that you shall notice the place where he lies, and you shall go and uncover his feet and lie down. Then he shall tell you what you shall do." Imagine if you're Ruth. You're like, what? Again, our understanding is this is not like normal Israelite practice necessarily. We're not following prescribed guidelines here necessarily. So Naomi describes what Ruth is to do, and then Ruth says, verse 5, she said to her, "All that you say, I will do." And she went down to the threshing floor and did according to all that her mother-in-law had commanded her. When Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. She came secretly and uncovered his feet and lay down. It happened in the middle of the night that the man was startled, understatement of the year, and bent forward, and behold, a woman was lying at his feet. You know the story, but you're like, what? Whoa. And he said, the greatest words ever, "Who are you?" Like, can't you think of anything better than that? But I suppose that's, what would you say? Who are you? Which, by the way, indicates to us he's not thinking, oh, it's Ruth. She showed up. She figured it out. So who in the world is this? No idea. And she answered, "I am Ruth, your maid. So spread your covering over your maid, for you are a close relative." Verse 10, then he said, "May you be blessed of the Lord, my daughter. You have shown your last kindness to be better than the first by not going after young men, whether poor or rich. Now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you whatever you ask, for all my people in the city know that you are a woman of excellence. Now it is true I am a close relative. However, there is a relative closer than I. Remain this night. When morning comes, if he will redeem you, good. If he let him redeem you, but if he does not wish to redeem you, then I will redeem you. As the Lord lives, lie down until morning. We'll stop there. You really see, so you're reading text going, mind blown. What is going on? But before we jump into the specifics of what is happening, and I love the Bible, just I'm lays things out. This is what happened. This is, you're not varnishing this narrative in any way, as we'll see. There's all purity that comes out of this, all right, rather dangerous situation. So there's nothing impure that's happening here. Nonetheless, we're looking at the situation going, I mean, what is happening? Why is this going on? How will this end? What does this have to do with being redeemed? Why does Ruth even obey what Naomi says? Why does Naomi come with all these questions to be springing to your mind when you read the biblical narrative? But before we answer those questions, I have a question for you. What is your goal? If you could give me one sentence statement, right? What is your goal in your relationship with your parents before you leave home? What do you want to have accomplished? Give me one sentence. I want to have accomplished this when it comes to the relationship you have with your mom and dad. What do you want to have accomplished by the time you leave home or by the time you're done with your high school years? Yes? You wanted to have trusted them, or you want them to have trusted you? Okay. So you want to have a trusting relationship. Good. So you want to build a trusting relationship. Excellent. What's something you want to do? You want to have honored your parents. So when you finish out on your diploma, what you want is, Rebecca honored her parents. Okay. Dane trusted his parents. They trusted him. Yeah. Okay, healthy, godly relationship, all right? That is not tainted by, well, we could fill out in the blanks, probably rebellion, and one that is built around the things of God, godly. All right, what else? Healthy, godly relationship, trusting. All right, you want to have gained wisdom from them. Excellent. So Lydia gained all the wisdom possible from mom and dad, right? Well, but that's what you would want on there, right? Sought to gain all the wisdom possible, yes. You want to have a loving and caring relationship. That is, it's emotionally warm, and it is a blessing. What else? Good. What else do you want to have accomplished with your parents by the time you're done? Nothing else to add to that? Yes? Okay, honest. Trustworthy, honest. That is, and I think important component to that is what? That you've been honest with them, and that prayerfully they've also been honest with you. They've been willing to speak with you about who they are. That'd be sweet. Joshua had honest relationship with mom and dad. Didn't hide anything. Nothing hidden. That'd be sweet, yeah. Okay, respectful. Again, mostly in one sense on your side, because it's the nature of those who are under authority to be respectful of authority, that when you graduate, Selena, respectful of her mom and dad. Anybody else? Good, yeah. Okay. Where you talked with one another. Right, where you were able to sit down and have good conversations. I mean, what parent wouldn't want on your diploma, you know, Marie talked to her mom and dad a lot, right? I mean, because you wouldn't want Marie never said anything to mom and dad. Give mom and dad the silent treatment every other day. All right. Anything else? Those are great. Anything else you want to have accomplished by the time you graduate? Yeah. Okay. Them to be proud of you. Or you to be proud of the nature of your relationship? Okay, so Karsten did his parents proud. That's pretty cool. I mean, that'd be a good way to graduate. Your parents are like, wow, I'm proud of you, son. You did a good job. Excellent. Good. Anybody else? Oh, I only get one. Anyone else? All right. How many have never thought about that before? I mean, directly. Never really thought about it. Okay, some of you. All right. And I'm not going to, you don't raise your hand on this one. How many of you are actually accomplishing that? Don't raise your hand on that. Because the next question I might ask you is, what's your plan? Those are some great things. I think probably most of you would have things that you wanted to do to your parents. But are you working the plan, or has your plan gotten derailed in selfishness? Or you might have even had some of those thoughts, and on good days you do, but on bad days you're like, why are my parents doing this for me, and this for me, and this for me, and this for me? I know I'm supposed to have this good communicative relationship with my parents, but I really do not want to talk to them at all. They bug me, and I'm not happy with them. You know, all the excuses. You got to be really careful, you guys. When you set certain habits, you reap a response in the relationship. So it's really when you do certain actions, you make habits. When you make those habits, you set yourself a reputation. When you set yourself a reputation in a relationship, you build the tone and the value of that relationship. So you got to be careful. Sometimes you think, well, I'm doing well, but you haven't really noticed that daily you are getting less communicative or more selfish or just kind of thinking about the relationship in terms of what you're getting. So my prayer is that you would be carefully considering, particularly in relationship with your parents, and the question that I want you to ponder tonight as we consider Ruth's marriage proposal, because that's what this is. When you then step out into these bigger picture issues, because think of all the things that are coming for you. You know, you've got to have to make a decision as to where you're going to go to school, and then what kind of, you know, what major you're going to pursue, or what trade you're going to do if you choose not to go to school, what work you're going to do in order to press forward. Then you're going to have to choose, you know, how you're stepping forward in relationship, and most of you will make the choice somewhere in the next, you know, 4 to 8 years, certainly, of the person that you will marry. And so you got all these big things that you're making. Are you going to make those choices in light of just what you want, or in light of what is a blessing, not only to you, but also to your family, and I would add into that, the church? Are you thinking of all of your relationships in light of all of your other relationships, or are you thinking them simply in terms of selfishness? This is what I want, and this is what I'm going to get. And so I'll manipulate, or I'll work it around so that everybody in my life gives me what I want. That's often how we use our relationships. And you probably don't enter into relationships necessarily desiring that, but that's what happens because it's so easy to focus on yourself. We're going to be looking at relationships, and we have been all throughout this text, that are focused on others. I'm not going to set up Ruth, and you know, so don't get all scared tonight. Like, Boaz is an older man, Ruth is a younger woman, and Boaz is, or Ruth is seeking to honor her mother-in-law by trying to take care of her. I'm not saying you have to build your, go find some older man so you can, you know, make money to pay for your parents. The pattern of the narrative is not what we're going to focus on. The heart of the people involved in the narrative is what I'm going to focus on. So you don't have to follow this pattern, and in fact, I'm going to encourage you, don't follow this particular pattern, all right? But I am going to encourage you to follow this attitude. And all along the way, Ruth, Naomi now growing in an attitude that pleases and honors the Lord, Boaz continually pouring out his life to minister first to just some widow. Some widow who even he had some responsibility to, was in his family, but no lawful responsibility to, just some foreign widow whom he desired to pour out blessing upon, and in that way to bless his extended family when he had no real true requirement to do so. There's so many sweet things happening in this text, and so different than the relationships in the world. Because I long for you to be able to look at relationships in a biblical pattern. And I know sometimes you get caught up in specifics that we talk about here, if we're talking about dating or talking, and you're like, oh, I don't like that, or I don't like that. Okay, I get it. If there's certain things you're like, why are you telling? Get the heart of what we're talking about. That relationships are about others, that relationships are about the Lord, that relationships are about purity always, because purity is the greatest blessing that you can give to the one you have a relationship with and to all the people around you. It's about provision and grace that you are providing. Your relationships are never just about you because you're a Christian. Like you play frisbee differently, you certainly ought to be dating differently, and you certainly ought to be thinking about your relationships totally differently than the world does. And I always want you to be thinking, now, well, you know, did this youth group or this church say we ought to do this in relationship? What does the Bible say? And how can we be different from what the world expects? And how can you change your thinking? Guys, this is just shattering when it comes to the worldly narrative of my relationships are all about me. I do it for how I'm going to benefit. I do it purely based on the attraction that I might have for some other person. And then that drives me towards a relationship that nobody can stop. That's the opposite of this text. And so we're going to try to work our way through the underlying heart attitudes that are going to build a healthy relationship, not only one that might end in marriage for you, but also one with your parents, also one with your friends and those in the church, and even extends out into your siblings, those that you spend a lot of time with now. So let's try to work our way through this. Our tendency in relationships is to view them from an entirely selfish and emotional lens. The proper biblical view of relationships, however, is how will God be pleased? How will others be ministered to? How will my own soul more carefully reflect the character of the Lord Jesus Christ? God has designed our relationships to be a picture of his character. We should pursue them in a way that puts His grace, His mercy, His love, His holiness, and His provision on display. I mean, you want to turn the world upside down as young people? Then pursue your relationships in a way that reflects this kind of character of God. People expect a lot of things of young people. They don't expect that. Nobody is pushing you really to do that. They're pushing you to say, look, do whatever you want. Have relationships in whatever way you desire. Do your own thing, because that's freedom, isn't it? That's slavery and bondage to your own selfish desires. And I don't want you to go there. So let's get some principles. We probably won't make it all the way through this text tonight, so don't be too afraid. We'll do the best that we can as we look at the various aspects of the individuals here pursuing relationship. Remember, we are flowing out of Ruth's faithful work in the fields for 6 or 7 weeks, making provision for her mother-in-law day in and day out. Naomi, it seems, growing in hope as she thinks about the provision that Boaz has made, as she's contemplating how this might work out to be a blessing to Ruth, probably waiting every day. If I had to guess, as I'm not a Jewish mother-in-law, but if I had to kind of put myself in that mindset, and I'm not even sure exactly how I would do that, but every day, just as a parent, every day, Naomi probably wondering, I wonder if Boaz is going to say something today. And so, see, you know, every time Ruth comes home, it's like, so how'd it go? How was the gleaning? Did you see Boaz? Again, we don't see that Ruth or Boaz in any way seems to be aware of this or pursuing this at all, but this is clearly on Naomi's mind, because the moment that the time ends and nothing has happened, Naomi's like, it's time for something to happen. You know, if you have had the privilege of watching one really certain long movie, Fiddler on the Roof, how does it go? You know, it's matchmaker, matchmaker, make me a match. And I won't sing you the whole song, because then you'll throw up. But there it is. You got the old Jewish mother-in-law who's going to make the match. Well, that's what's going to happen here. So for chapter 3, verse 1, then Naomi said to her mother-in-law, look, we left it in chapter 23, or verse 23 of chapter 2 at the end. She lived with her mother-in-law. And Naomi's like, this is not going to cut it. This is not what I had in mind. I want to make, and the key here is that Naomi is at this point now not looking for provision for herself. Nothing about the text tells us that secretly Naomi is trying to manipulate Ruth so that she, Naomi, can be taken care of. What did she say in chapter 1? I want you to have a husband so that you can be secure, safe, happy, and healthy. That's what I want. So I'm sending you back to Moab. Bad idea. Okay, Orpah, boom, gone. Nobody ever hears of her again, and it probably didn't go well. Ruth remains in the Bible, in the story, in the history, then in the line of Christ. Not that all faithful women got to be that. But nonetheless, bad idea Naomi has at first. You got to have a husband, so go back to Moab, because I can't provide you one. Ruth makes the better choice. I'm going to stay with you. I'm going to be committed. But always Naomi's point has been, look, I can't make provision, so don't come. Ruth says, no, I'm going to make provision for you. And you will find always that when your heart is to make provision for others, when your heart is to be used of God, to pour into the life of others, He always makes provision for you. I'm not going to say He always gives you the husband you want, or the wife you want, or the cars. He always makes provision for you, because that's how it comes. Ruth makes the right choice. And it blesses, it ends up, guys, get this, it ends up blessing Naomi, not simply so that Naomi will be provided for, which she will, but so that Naomi can be the means, really, and can help Ruth be provided for. The one thing that Naomi longs to do, to be a provider for Ruth. And actually, Ruth's faithfulness puts Naomi in the position where she can help do that. I mean, you know how it is. Don't you long to be a benefit to others? And when you can't be and you watch their life, and you're like, oh, I wish I could bless you. I wish I could help you. I wish I could do something, right? You've probably got friends who are in difficult circumstances, and you wish you could do something. Well, God has been so good to Naomi that in the midst of her bitterness and struggle, that because of Ruth's faithfulness, Naomi's now in a place where she can be a blessing. Wow, God is good, is He not? Even in the midst of our foolishnesses. So this is Naomi's plan, and Naomi is motivated by love. Then my daughter, by the way, this is very endearing language now. Where did this come from? First, when Ruth says, look, I will, makes this incredible commitment. I'll go where you go. I'll lodge where you lodge. I'll die where you die. Your God will be my God. And Naomi just turns around and walks off. They walk into Bethlehem, and they say, here's Naomi. She's come, you know, is this Naomi? She goes, no, I am not full. I'm not blessed. I'm empty. I'm Mara. I'm bitterness. As Ruth stands right next to her, making no acknowledgement. They go in and they sit in the house, whatever little house, hovel they have on the edge of town, and Naomi's statement is, you can go out and glean some grain. But now, as Naomi is warming, as her heart is changing, as she's returning and responding to the Lord, my daughter. Now we have a term of endearment. Now we have Naomi warming to this relationship. And I wonder if it's because now she realizes I'm actually going to be able. It seems I've got a plan in place. I've got some hope that I can actually make provision for this one. And maybe, and I'm convinced that part of her bitterness has been that she's had been angry at the Lord that she can't make the provision that she wants to make. She said that at the beginning, I want to make provision. God has not allowed that, had not allowed that up to this point. So she's angry at God. Why can't I be the blessing that I want to be? Why can't I accomplish the one function of my motherhood that I desire, which is to make provision for my children? And talk to parents. You can never understand until you become a parent. The drive of a parent to make provision for their children. It is their passion. Now, the problem is oftentimes it becomes so much of a passion that it overcomes their passion for Christ. And they enable their kids, and they do things for the kids that they should never do, and they push and manipulate their kids. But a lot of that is driven by, it begins with a heart that says, look, I want to make provision for you. It just gets tainted with sin because that's the way we are. But she goes, never doubt the heart of your parents to make provision for you. When push comes to shove, that's what they want. And even though it doesn't always look like that to you, when that is taken from them, there is no greater heartbreak for a parent than that they would be removed from the ability to make provision for their children. Sometimes the children do it, or they remove themselves from the situation in their rebellion and in their anger, and they leave, or they become emotionally distant. Guys, that kills your parents. Not simply because, they just want to manipulate me, they just want to control me. No, because they want to provide for you. And they know that relationship and your ability to respond to them and them to you is the primary way in which that provision is going to be made. Naomi is heartbroken, at least for one reason, that she has not been able to make provision for Ruth. And now she begins to see that there's a chance, and she goes after it wholeheartedly. I mean, she goes all the way with this weird plan to get Ruth a husband. So here we go. No, and she's motivated by love. This is what she wants. She says, all right, shall I not seek security for you? That's what parents do. And remember that your parents, if they're pushing you biblically, pushing you to come to church, pushing you to be holy, pushing you to not exercise freedoms that they know will not be good for you, understand that they are seeking to make provision, that they want to be security for you. It's one of the primary jobs of a parent is to try to keep their sinful children, even believing children, from doing stupid things. Sinful things that will have an ongoing impact in your life. So they hold you back and they say, no, you can't do that. And no, you can't have that. And no, you can't go there. And no, that relationship is not for now. And you're like a little kid just grabbing for it. I got to have that. I got to have that. You're digging in the closet and you're dragging out the chemicals. You're like, I got to have that. I got to drink that. And your parents are like, no. Imagine the parent that went, yeah, I'm going to learn by example here. crawled under the closet, grabbed out, the Tide pod, start sucking on that baby. The parents are like, that'll show them. I'm giving them some freedom. That'd be really good for them. They end up in the emergency room. You think your parents don't think the same thing when you're about to have a relationship and they think it's going to be toxic and they're like, uh-uh. Oh, let's let them do that. That'll be good for them. That'll show them. Because they know and they understand the kind of entanglements that those things can bring. I'm asking you to give your parents a little more credit than you sometimes do in your selfishness. Now, I know many of you, most of you, have deep respect for your parents, but your heart and your desires get involved, and you think that you know better, and you have no idea. So please, Naomi's one desire is to provide security for Ruth. She wants to be the means by which Ruth is secure and blessed and taken care of. And she says, is not Boaz our kinsman with whom your maids were? Again, this idea of one who legally could be responsible for buying back the land, marrying Ruth, making provision for her for the long haul. So he has that chance. He's not just some dude. He's not just some guy that's really rich. He is a kinsman. That is one who has interest in the matter. One who has stake in the game, as it were, as one of the family members who would appropriately take on this task. So she's got good hope. She's not just picking somebody out there. And she already knows the character of Boaz. She has seen the provision that Boaz has made. 6 weeks now that Ruth has gone to his field and not been abused and not been taken advantage of. He's made protection and provision for her. Wise mother-in-law who has watched and looked and seen what this man has done, recognizing that he's not just a potential kinsman redeemer, but he also is a man of character who will be a blessing. He's not going to throw her off into some, you know, unfortunately she began with, look, go back to Moab and find an unbelieving husband. Ah, not good, Naomi. But now, as she sees the character of Boaz, recognizes his opportunity as a kinsman, he goes, look, you were with his maids this whole time. He protected and guarded you. So this is one who could be a blessing to you. God is gracious to allow Naomi a second chance to do this right and to have brought into Ruth's life this man who has not taken advantage of her and who has been a tremendous blessing to her. As I've said before, there is no greater blessing in the world, two great blessings in the world, of a godly man who will use his authority and use his position wisely and well, and a godly woman who will also use the role that God has given her and operate within those roles in a way that's pleasing to the Lord. It's powerful. In Psalm 130, speaking of Naomi's sinfulness and her bad responses, you're like, why does Naomi deserve this? She doesn't. Nobody deserves a second chance. Nobody deserves an opportunity to try again after she made these really bad mistakes and said these really stupid things and didn't regard Ruth hardly at all. But now she's coming around. You want to know the beauty of being related to now, being in the family of a great God, is that he never holds your sin against you, ever. I mean, he will bring discipline for your sin as is necessary because he loves you. There will be consequences, but he never holds it against you as in, you want to do something good now, but you remember that bad thing you did a couple of weeks ago? Sorry. No grace for you. You're going to have to earn it now. You blew it. Earn your way back into my graces. See, that's how we think God treats us, and that's how we treat other people. We forgive them, and we expect that they have to earn their way back into our giving of grace. Now, this is entirely apart from, if you've broken trust, you have to work on trust issues. I understand those are true, but at the bottom line, every person who is a child of God benefits completely from the total grace of God to provide forgiveness when there is sin and to continue to provide and pour out his blessings upon those who are responding. Psalm 130, verses 3 and 4. Oh Lord, if you should mark iniquities, who could stand? If you just kept chalking them up and then held them against me, guys, you'd be done. But there is forgiveness with you that you may be feared. God is not looking at you and saying, well, you sinned really bad last week, and so a little less grace for you this week. He never responds in that way. He pours out his grace, and he's doing so for Naomi. Naomi is doing this out of love. God is giving her the second chance. She's seeking to make this provision, and in this case, she has chosen wisely. The Lord has put her in a position where she can. Now, Naomi is then very clear in her instruction. Like a good mom, good mother-in-law would be. She's thought this out very carefully. I want to provide security for you. The security that you need is going to be found, as we said, in that society most particularly, in marriage to a man who can make this kind of provision. A godly man who has means and desire to provide. We know he has means. We know he's a godly man. Now what's going to happen is Naomi's going to test and see whether Boaz has desire, whether he wants to be the kinsman redeemer. She's going to force his hand. And there's a couple reasons why I think this is going on, why it was necessary for her to have to push in this way. Because one, Boaz is very clearly treading very lightly here because he knows, as we saw in our text, he's not the primary redeemer. He doesn't have first rights to do this. So he's doing nothing which might indicate that he's trying to get in the way of the guy who is the first redeemer, who would be aware of this whole situation at some levels. So he's being very careful to do that. He's also being very careful to treat Ruth with absolute purity and holiness. He's not coming on to her. He's not, somehow trying to entrap her in some way. He's very carefully keeping his distance, which is very wise in relationships when there is no commitment and there is no, he's not flirting with her. He's not doing any of that stuff. He's being very careful, rightfully so. He has no thought that Ruth would be interested in him in that way. This seems to be a very wise man who doesn't think more of himself than he should. Yeah, certainly she's interested in me. None of those things. And Ruth also is being extremely careful all during this time. She's not flirting with the other young men. As she just comes home every night. She's not trying to get something out of Boaz, although certainly in that culture, that's what you did. It's no different than our culture today. You get ahead by what? By flirting, by trying to enter into a relationship, by getting sexual favors. All of the things that happen in our society today are the things that happened back then, only more so. But none of that is happening. Everyone here is conducting themselves. Most likely also, Ruth has continued to wear her and be in mourning as a widow. Almost certainly when Naomi tells Ruth to change her clothes, she's saying, look, it's time to stop being a widow and it's time to start pursuing a husband. Your time for mourning is done. Take off the widow's clothes and put on good clothes. I think that's indicated by the text here. Because all during this time, it would not have been appropriate as almost certainly Ruth is identifying herself as a widow, and they did that by the kind of clothing that they would wear, it's entirely inappropriate for Boaz to do anything. And everybody has operated in holiness and purity here, and so now Naomi's like, all right, it's time to move the ball forward. All right, so here's her plan. All right, so Naomi is instructive. First, she says, and this is a good plan, wash yourself, anoint yourself. Put on your best clothes. The text doesn't say best clothes, it just says clothes. And I think that's why it means take off the widow's dress, put on real clothes. Because the word is just for a garment, an outer garment. Nothing special, not a wedding dress or some really, you know, slinky thing. It simply is, look, put on a dress. Put on what you would wear as a young woman. Put that on. Now it's time. Okay? Change out your other clothing and present yourself. Right? You don't want to be stinky from the fields, which is where she's been out working. All right? As we'll see, Ruth has carried home 30, 40 pounds of grain the first night. My guess is that was every day for 6 weeks. She's walking around in the field carrying home the grain, right? Whatever she, you know, whatever her physicality was, this was a strong woman who was able to accomplish what she needed. She was a hard worker. So now it's time to move out of hard-working woman mode and work into woman looking for a husband mode. However that might look. I'm not saying from the narrative that, you know, got to wash yourself and put on your deodorant all the time, but that's probably a good idea, all right? If you're going to go ask a man to marry you, all right, which is what's going to happen here, all right? So she says, be attractive, go to the threshing floor. Now, here's where this gets a little dicey, and again, there may be some underlying tradition here that was known. Naomi may be flying by the seat of her pants a bit here and trying to put this together. I don't know. I'm saying don't follow, be careful of following narrative patterns. We can follow biblical principles, the nature of each person's heart here, what actually gets accomplished in holiness. But I wouldn't say that this would be, you know, that you would go find a husband by, he finishes out his work at, you know, he's been working, maybe works at the farm somewhere, and they've finished out their harvest, and they're hanging out at the silo, and at nighttime you would go and lie down. This is a different, we have a culture gap here. But nonetheless, this is how Naomi describes this so that it seems to be, for whatever reason, the one way or the best way in Naomi's mind to move this relationship forward, to really say, look, Boaz, we want you to do this. We want you to be the kinsman redeemer. Why couldn't they have done it in the day? I don't know all of those reasons. This appears to be what Naomi felt like would be the best way. So she's supposed to go down to the threshing floor. She's supposed to wait. It says, wait until Boaz has eaten and drunk and is, and then lie down at his feet. All right? He has finished eating and drinking. It shall be when he lies down that you shall notice the place where he lies. You shall go and uncover his feet and lie down, and then he will tell you what to do. And I think exactly what the text says is exactly what she was going to do. She's not going down to proposition him for physical intimacy, which is what people read into this text all the time, but the text does not say that. Go down and do what? Uncover his feet. That's not some special code words for physical intimacy. It isn't. All right? That's not in the text. Uncover his feet. Take the blanket off his feet. It's weird. I know. Okay. This isn't how I would prescribe for you to find a husband in this way. But nonetheless, she's supposed to go down. He's, you know, they're out in the open. He's lying next to the sacks of grain. Uncover his feet and lie down there. All right? So after he has laid down and gone to bed, this is what you do. And verse 5, right? So Ruth is obedient. And again, there's a culture gap. We don't know exactly why. We don't know all of the nature of the custom. But what we are going to find is that Ruth seems to know what to say to ask Boaz for his hand in marriage, not for sexual favors. I said we have to put on our adult, young adult thinking, That's not what she's asking for, because that happens in our society all the time. Well, the first thing that happens is a proposition towards sex. That's constant. I mean, we've got apps where you swipe right or swipe left based on what you want to do physically. Right? That is not what's happening here. It's not the swipe right, swipe left for how deeply we want to get involved. This is going to be a marriage proposal. Strange to us, weird, but not a proposal for physical intimacy. There's a lot of other ways to do that. This wouldn't have been the way to do that. Okay, so nonetheless, that's what's happening. We don't know all the reasons driving it, but there is a holy purpose, which is marriage. Ruth, as we will see, understands it, says words to that effect, and Boaz also understands what's happening, as we will see, and that he's not being propositioned in some ungodly or unholy way. So again, however they knew that, here's what's going on. Ruth obeys then. Ruth's obedience. All that you say, I will do. She's eager in this instruction from her mother-in-law, although, again, that she's not exhibited up to this point any desire to run and try and get in good with Boaz. Now, Naomi says, okay, it's time. Nothing has happened. There's not been any progress. Boaz has not said anything. Ruth has not proposed or pushed in any way. Naomi has been kind of waiting to see, I think waiting on Boaz. He doesn't do that. Now, Ruth, in obedience to her mother-in-law, and as we will see overall in our text, I think with a desire not simply to make provision for herself, Naomi wants to make provision for Ruth, and Ruth wants to make provision for who? For Naomi. And so she's willing to obey here because what she's going to go ask in her own mind very clearly is that Boaz might marry her, and she knows that in that way provision will be made so that not only will she be taken care of, but Naomi will be as well. So she obeys. She goes to do that thing which is best. And that's the principle that I want you to understand. Naomi is asking something that I would not want your parents to ask of you in this way. But what Naomi is doing is she's directing Ruth in a way that will make good provision for Ruth and will be a blessing and security to her. And your parents often do this kind of thing for you and you ignore them. They say, do this, try this, go here, let me help you with this. Don't do it this way, do it this way. You understand the application I'm making here? I'm not saying the parents ought to tell you to go lie down and uncover a man's feet. I'm telling you that what Naomi is doing here is seeking to make provision for Ruth, and Ruth's desire is to respond because she knows that in being made provision for by Naomi, in this case, she will also be being a blessing to her parents. How often do you think of it that way? If I obey them, as they're seeking to make provision for me, it will be a blessing back to them rather than always just kind of gauging it on, what is this for me? How much of a blessing is this for me? How much of this do I want to do? What do I think I'm going to get out of life if my parents tell me to do something and you base it on what you're going to get, not on the blessing you will be to them if you would do what they say? Willingly choosing to come underneath their authority and do what they say. Even sometimes as you're getting older. Again, there's no pattern here for arranged marriages, that's what ought to happen. You know, every mom ought to make an arrangement for an arranged marriage. But I would say this, you ought to listen carefully to your parents when it comes to relationships. And the kind of things they say, I don't think that's wise. Well, you just don't know. Are you your parents don't know about relationships? They've been in one probably for 20 years, and you're telling them you don't know about. You're telling your dad you don't know about women. You're insulting your dad. You're telling your mom. Yeah, I mean you don't know. Not this one. You don't know, and you do. I mean, you went wet behind the ears. I mean, I love you guys, but how much relational experience have you had in comparison to your parents, regardless of what you think about them? Very little, very little. You would be wise. Okay, again, if they tell you to go uncover someone's feet, then come talk to me. We'll work on that. But if they tell you the things that they do, which are be careful, be wise, watch out, then you certainly ought to, I'm trying to make provision for you so that your life isn't miserable. Do you really think your parents want you to end up in a marriage to an unbeliever or a marriage to a man or a woman who will ravage your life? Or maybe they think that you at your stage of life would harm someone if you were in a relationship, and so trying to hold you back so that some other person doesn't get harmed by your sinfulness and foolishness? Do you really think your parents are not working for that desire? Well, they are. So she has willing obedience. She has total obedience. I'll do everything you say. She is willing to consider Naomi's needs at this level more important than her own. We don't know if there's truly an emotional desire here. There might be, but probably not. And I am also not advocating, hey, you know, just get married with, you know, if it seems like a good match and it'll be helpful for your parents. That's not the point. And just don't have to have any emotional attachment. That's not the point. I am saying this. You should be building your relationships based on what is a blessing and benefit to others, not simply the emotional bang for your buck. You ought to be doing that. It's nice to have emotional bang as well. That's a great thing. It's like, whoa, that's great. And you can build that over time also. But if you start your relationships that way, if that's the kind of thing they're built on, it's really fleeting. I think you already know that. You know that that doesn't last. You know it doesn't hold, but it's so hard because there's no indication one way or the other that Ruth is like, wow, Boaz is great. If I had to guess, I would say she is attracted to his character. There are very few young women who wouldn't be attracted, and I'm not saying in a sexual sense or even necessarily in a pleasure sense, but that she views him with respect and honor. I would say that's almost certainly the case. She's already in humility fallen down before him in an appropriate way, thanking him for his blessing, for his benefit. She knows the provision that he's made. And again, while I'm not trying to set a pattern of narrative here of exactly how you enter into a relationship, I would say this. If you don't have respect for the character of a guy that you are going to seek after in whatever way the relationship is, then you ought not be doing it. If you can't look past the emotion of what you have and can't see the godly nature of who he is, then you're not ready for a relationship. And your parents have often noted that. They're like, whoa, you're caught up in emotion. You can't see whether his character is good or bad. You've been blinded by your emotion, and they try to pull you back, not because they think your emotion is bad, but because they realize that you can't see past it. You're not mature enough yet. I would say a young man or a young woman is ready for marriage, not when they are super spiritual and have $1 million in the bank and have 10 degrees, but when they can recognize maturity and immaturity past their emotions. So you ought to be practicing now. Because I don't think you have to be 25 to do that. I think you can be 16, 17, 18. You shouldn't be getting married at 16, 17. I'm simply saying, I think you can be building that now. Teenagers just driven by emotion. There's nothing but an emotional ball of mess. No, you have the Spirit of God. You are able to think through your emotions. I don't treat you like that. I don't think you just are driven by emotions and you can't do anything else. I would never treat you like that. You have to work your way through them. And when you're mature enough to do that, you're probably mature enough to start to step towards a relationship, which is a sweet thing when it's time, right? Well, here it's time. Again, not exactly in the way that it'll be probably for any of you, exactly like this, but it's time, and so it's happening. Boaz's response. What is Boaz going to do? Now, again, we see the character of Naomi starting to grow as she is loving and properly directive. We see Ruth's continuing humility and desire to be a blessing, obedience in the right kind of way, where she knows that this will be a blessing, so she wants to respond. So let's look at Boaz. Now everybody's rounding into form. And again, guys, these are real people who really know God. And when you really know God and start to be driven by the work of the Spirit of God, be it externally through His Word and His people as is happening here, also working in the heart, although not personally indwelling them like He does today. Guys, when God starts to work in this way, people do amazing, godly, wonderful things. None of these people are perfect. I would still say the arrangement of this is not exactly as I think would be the most wise thing in the world. And yet because God is working here, what we see are godly people making godly responses, and that changes the world. You're not Jesus. You make mistakes. He's better than you. You're to look to Him. People are to look through you to Jesus, but they are never to look past you. You can never say, look, don't look at me, just look at Jesus. Don't look at Boaz, just look at Jesus. That's not what the text tells us. Boaz is loving God and makes provision then ultimately for Jesus to come. You are loving the Lord Jesus and making provision for other people to accept Him because they watch you. And raising godly children who will do the same. Yes, always look to Jesus, but never apart from you, through you, because of you, as you both do what is right and as you sin and fail, and God gives you grace like Naomi. Isn't this a wonderful picture? Everybody's not doing everything right here, and yet God is blessing and being gracious. So first we see, for your text, Boaz's response, or your notes, is one of my favorites. Boaz is merry. It's a great word. M-E-R-R-Y. He's happy and satisfied. He's not drunk, by the way. There are different words for that. He hasn't been overcome by his wine. Okay, that's, you know, when you're out of control in that state. This is a carefully, it's a joyful state of contentedness based on a successful harvest, having eaten his dinner, having had the appropriate beverages for the time. It does not appear that he imbibed over and above. Simply, when Boaz had eaten and drunk, and his heart was merry. I mean, you've ever had that? You had a super good dinner, you kicked back, and your mom provided the spread. You chowed it down, you had good fellowship, you'd had a good, strong day at school, and done all you needed to, and you finished out, and you just kicked back in the living room, and like, oh, that's good. I mean, I hope you have those kinds of days. I do. It's pretty sweet, right? And you're like, my heart's merry. I'm like, what a great day. It's not always like that. I'd love to say it's always like that. In the Reiser household, we just kind of sit around in the living room and go, oh, what a great day. We're all merry and happy. It's not always true. It is sometimes. And by the way, Boaz is receiving temporal reward for his hard work and faithfulness. Is the home of a man or a woman, or the job of a man or a woman who loves the Lord and is seeking to serve him, is that home a pleasant place to be? Yes, it is. Not always. They sin, I get it. But are there not rewards to the labor of serving and honoring the Lord and then enjoying the rich benefits that he provides of the wisdom that guides your home? It's sweet. It's sweet when that happens, and many of you partake of the rich benefits of a home in which there is this kind of joy. Boaz is happy, he is joyful, he's worked hard, he's been honest, he's treated his people with grace, he has blessed the Lord, he has treated Ruth properly. He's not perfect, but he has been honoring to the Lord, and he kicks back on the stack of grain after a great harvest that the Lord provided, great work that God granted, great attitude that is built around knowing and loving the Lord, and he's happy and joyful, and he kicks back to go to bed. The sleep, says Proverbs in a bit of a paraphrase, of the working man is sweet. It's sweet when you've worked hard, and he has, and he's reaping the benefits. His heart is merry. Now, he doesn't know what's going to happen, right? He has no idea what's about. His life is about to change. He's pretty happy with his life right like it is, but things are about to get kind of strange, all right? So here we go. He's merry. Next, we're going to see Boaz is startled, because as he's being merry and enjoying his time and lying down and, you know, getting ready to snooze, then Ruth has been watching, all right? And she came secretly and uncovered his feet. And again, like I said, the idea is he's over somewhere, you know, sleeping against one of the stacks of grain. They did that largely, and particularly in this time, because if you went back into the city and the grain was still out, when you came back the next day, what would be true? There would be no grain. They would come and steal it. And so he hasn't had time to put it away, to get it back into, you know, put it in the place or to get it into town. So they sleep there after they do the winnowing of the grain, taking it, remember, throwing it up in the air. Would have been an outcropping probably on the top of a hill where there's a rock so that they could crush the grain, then toss it up in the air. As the winds blew at night, it would blow away the chaff. They would then bind, they would have their grain ready to go. They would get it collected. Then they would go to bed because it would be late at night, very early in the morning probably. But they didn't want anybody to come and steal it. This was wise. So he crashes, she watches, he's lying down somewhere, apparently they all sleep really close together because she's able to sneak in there. She undoes the cover on his feet and then lies down, the text indicates, not by his side, but by his feet. She doesn't snuggle into the bed, as it were. She lies down by his feet, which is clearly indicating, will indicate something to him. So she's careful not to be seen. Boaz then, in the middle of the night, says the man was startled. What? Now, why do you think he woke up? Come on now. His feet are cold, all right? Have you ever had your feet, they stick out of the bed, all right? You're camping particularly, right? And your sleeping bag doesn't cover you. And in the middle of the night, you wake up and you're like, oh, I'm cold, all right? So you cover your feet. So just, this probably has happened to him before. He's done this multiple times where he's done the grain, went to bed, put on his covers. Maybe, you know, his covers have come off before, never in this way, all right? But he's calling, oh, what's going on? Oh, my feet are cold. He goes to put the covers over, and as he reaches down, he's like, there's a form at his feet. And this has not happened to Boaz before. This is new, okay? It's not like a woman comes every time he goes and does it. This is some, you know, immoral, you know, place where the men just get in drunken frenzies and the women show up. That did happen in many places, by the way. It probably was happening on other rock outcroppings and other places in Bethlehem, where it was turning into a place where favors were granted, sexual favors, but not here. And this is not Boaz's normal thing, and this has very clearly never happened to him before. And so he looks down, and there's a form at his feet as he goes to move the covers over, and he asks, of course, the thing. He's next to Boaz is puzzled. Who is this? Who are you? Of course, that's what he would ask, and kind of imply, what in the world are you doing at my feet? This is not a usual thing. It's not something he's planned. They didn't plan a secret liaison, you know, and on the grain field. All of this is totally stunning to Boaz because he's not been pursuing Ruth. He knows he's not the primary redeemer. Ruth has, again, most likely been in her widow garments, still mourning. So it's not been, none of this has been appropriate. So he's done nothing except be a blessing to her week in and week out. And now, and he doesn't know it's her at this point. He's not been waiting or expecting her to show up or anyone else. Someone is there. He wakes up and he's, oh, who are you? Ruth has an answer ready. This is fascinating. This either Naomi further instructed Ruth as to exactly what she was to say, or because what Naomi specifically said was, when you go do this and the man will tell you what to do. Well, Ruth either, again, Naomi told her to do this, or she goes one step further. Right? I think Naomi also gave her this instruction. Right? As to how she was going to make this proposal. He said, who are you? She answered immediately, I am Ruth, your maid. Okay, don't freak out. In one sense, maybe that would have freaked him out more. I'm Ruth, your maid. So spread your covering over your maid. Now again, all of this commentators have made all kinds of, see, yeah, she's really propositioning him. Yeah, the text is saying this is dark and shady. What does she ask? Just go with the text. Cover your maid, for you are a what? A close relative. I'm asking you to redeem me. I'm not asking you to have a sexual relationship with me. I'm asking you to redeem me. That's what I want. You are a close, that's the way she's approaching this. You're a close relative, not the guy I've been lusting after. All right? Not the guy in my dreams who I'm trying to take advantage of. Look, you're a relative. You can make provision. And who's in mind here? Naomi's in mind. Because as he makes the provision for her, then Naomi also will be provided for, because if he raises up a male son, what happens? Naomi gets her land back, she gets her line back, she gets her provision back. And so Ruth is here to enter into a relationship which will be a blessing to Naomi, even as Naomi is sending Ruth into the relationship so that it will be a blessing for her. Two people trying to bless each other, and then ultimately we're going to have a man who blesses them both. This is sweet. And again, I wouldn't pick the time or place. I wouldn't arrange to have it done this way. And yet everyone here is acting in utter holiness as they walk this out. She lies at his feet. He opens it up. Who are you? She says, I am Ruth, your maid. Spread your covering over your maid because you are a close relative. What does the spread your covering remind you of in Ruth chapter 2? Anything? Do you remember what Boaz said to Ruth? Why he commended her? What did he commend her for in Ruth chapter 2? Anybody? You can look at verse 12, and maybe you can answer it for me. What does Boaz commend Ruth for? Somebody read verse 12 for me. Anybody? Raise your hand. Read it. Okay, Daniel.
May the Lord reward your work and your wages be full from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to seek refuge.
Boaz commends Ruth because he understands that her coming back is not simply about just Naomi. It's about honoring and pleasing the Lord. And so he commends her for coming to find refuge underneath the wings of the Lord. In a very similar kind of language here, what Ruth says essentially is, yes, I'm coming to find refuge from the Lord, and I'm asking you to be the means of that provision. Would you cover me? Would you cover me? And apparently, this is technical language for a marriage proposal. And it is not technical language for a sexual proposal. Would you cover me? Cover me because you are the close. Spread your covering over your maid because you are. Literally, it is spread your wings over me. Almost the exact phrase used where Boaz commends her for coming to find her protection underneath the Lord. And now she's saying, look, yes, the Lord provides protection, but you're the one that can do this. And now I'm asking that you would step into that place. Now I'm specifically asking you to be the redeemer that you can be. Essentially, she's giving him permission to do that which he clearly wants to do, but has not felt it appropriate up till this time. What a guy. What a girl. Guys, this is holiness walked out in a dangerous situation. Again, This could be, if you don't have holy people here, a dangerous thing. And certainly I would never be saying, you know, place yourself in a position where you might be able to enter into physical intimacy and no one would know. But that isn't the issue that's going on here. And so, in their holiness, each one responds properly. Boaz is puzzled, but Ruth is proactive. Spread joy. And again, it would seem that this was necessary, that he wasn't the one that could move in this direction until he was asked. Well, either he didn't feel it was right, or somehow he would view it as unlawful to do so, because we know that everything Boaz does is according to God's law. I mean, again, everything, he was a sinner, but his work is run according to God's law, his personal life is run according to God's law, the way that he cares for people is running according to the law of God that he's supposed to be honoring. Everything he does is by the book, if we might say it that way, in the right way. Not some kind of legalistic, self-righteous standard of holiness that's fake, but a biblical standard that's driven out of love, which is the way we should obey. And that's what he does. Boaz is appreciative. Notice what he says. Hop into bed with me, babe. That's the way the Hollywood story would go, and that's the way too many commentators have it. It's not what he says. And he could have. She's right there. He could have taken advantage of her. And he does not. What does he say? It's sweet what he says. He says, now my daughter. Excuse me. Then he said, may you be blessed of the Lord. Who's the first person on his mind in the midst of this? Yahweh, the covenant-keeping God, not his own sexual passion. Would that more men would act in this way in their relationships. That the first thing on their mind would be, is God being blessed? Is God being honored? Is God the one that is in charge of this? And that's clearly what's happening here. His first thought on his mind is, may you be blessed of the Lord, my daughter. You have shown your last kindness to be better than the first. What was the first kindness? That you came from the land of Moab to minister to your mother-in-law, Naomi. But now you've gone past that by not going after young men, whether poor or rich. Regardless of how they might have made provision for you, you have not gone after men, hear me, who wouldn't be a blessing to Naomi. Because if she marries someone else, Naomi's out of the equation. Now, she might make some provision from whatever you get, but Naomi loses her land, she loses her heritage, she loses the legal means by which she continues on to have a name in Israel. And so Boaz says, you're blessed. That not only did you come and are making provision for your mother-in-law and working in my field, but now you're looking to make, as it were, eternal or ongoing provision for her by reestablishing her line. You're blessed of the Lord. He understands that this is not some kind of passionate proposal to hop into bed with him. He understands that this is a proposal of marriage by which the line of Naomi might be raised up, and he immediately thanks her for her goodness in doing this. Would that the thing you were most appreciative about, young men, in the women that were pursuing you or the women you were thinking about, is that they were honoring and pleasing the Lord and not just thinking about themselves. I love it if they love you. I love it if they're all about you. I love it if they're a lot about you. They think you're nice and cool. But what you really need is that they would be commending your godliness and that they would think of you as godly, that you, young men, would be considering that in the young woman that you're going after, and that you, young woman, would be blessed by that instead of, oh, you're so beautiful, oh, you're so wonderful, oh, I feel so emotionally, googly when I'm with you. Again, some bad things. I had plenty of emotional googlies when I was with my wife. But my primary appreciation of her always, by the Lord's grace, was that she loved the Lord and wanted to serve the Lord. And that's Boaz's primary appreciation. Your last kindness is better than the first. What does he say? So you haven't gone after the young men, whether poor or rich. You could have satisfied yourself. You probably could have gotten one of those young men, and you probably could have gotten them to marry you, and you probably could have gotten an inheritance. You would have cast aside your mother-in-law who you said that you would die with. And you have followed that all the way through to this very marriage proposal. Because this is really sweet beyond measure. I can't even really communicate it well. The text is over the top. And this is a real story, real narrative. As it pictures, really, the incredible, gracious redemption of our Lord. Yes, it points ahead to that. I get that. But these are real people in a real situation, really doing these things because they love a real God right then. As then God uses that to point ahead to the loving Redeemer who will buy you back and make provision for you and establish your line for all of eternity to his own blessing as well as yours. It's incredible. So this first kindness is, this last kindness is better than the first. And then, oh, now my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you whatever you ask. I'll redeem you. I want, that is my, it's almost, very clearly, I've been waiting. And again, because I don't know the customs, because we have this culture gap, I don't know why he couldn't do anything about it before, but apparently he felt like he couldn't. Now, for whatever reason, based upon what Ruth has done and what Naomi has put together, he now is released to do the thing he's wanted to do. Because instantly he responds, yep, I'll do it. Whatever you ask, that is, this redeeming that you are asking of me, which includes marrying you, very clearly, yep, I'm all about it, I'll do it. But there's a problem. Now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you whatever you ask for. So Boaz here is appreciative. He was merry. He was startled. He was puzzled. He is appreciative of Ruth's godliness. And then Boaz is gracious. I will do whatever you ask. She's a Moabite woman. His own character is going to be stained and dragged through the mud because he marries a foreigner when he does this. His own inheritance is going to be in jeopardy because if they have only one male child, then that male child will be Naomi's line, and all of the blessing and benefit of the land will go to Naomi and not to him. He's putting his reputation in jeopardy. He's putting his inheritance in jeopardy. Why? Because he is head over heels in puppy love with Ruth? No, because this is what will be a blessing and benefit to her. Again, I'm not saying you can't marry when you're head over heels in one sense. Although it sounds kind of dangerous, you're like you're rolling down a hill. I wouldn't encourage loving someone like you're falling down a mountain. But nonetheless, this is carefully considered. This will be a tremendous blessing. And so absolutely I'll do this because I long to be this gracious blessing to you. And again, I would say, young men, that really is in many ways why you would say yes in a marriage proposal. You're supposed to make it. This is opposite way. But why you would even enter into this proposal is why? Because I want to be the greatest possible spiritual blessing to you that I can. Yes, you're awesome. Yes, you're cool. Yes, you're beautiful. Any of those things. And all those are good. If I was sitting in marriage counseling someone and the guy's like, I don't think she's very nice and I don't think she looks very good, but I'm married because that's be for her spiritual benefit. All right, we need to talk. That's not going to go super well. But I really have rarely had that problem. I have had the other problem. I'm only interested in you for you. And you're good looking, and you make me look good. I have sometimes had that problem. And you guys, it needs to be. If you're going to marry someone that you can be a spiritual blessing to them, young men, are you ready to be a spiritual blessing in a long-term sense to a young woman? Then you're ready to start pursuing marriage, and not until then. And you don't have to be 55 to do that. 18, 19, 20, if you were preparing now, you could be prepared. If you're not preparing now, it's going to take some time. Can you look a woman in the eye and say, I long to be a spiritual blessing to you, to make provision for you. I long to make my home with you because this will be a blessing not only to you, but to everyone around us. I long for our marriage to be the kind of marriage which will bless your parents and my parents, which will bless the church, which will bless those outside of us. That's why I'm marrying you. When I sit with couples and when we do the marriage couple, you know, we do the first thing I'm asking them is, what's your marriage about? Is it about you or is it about the bigger picture of what God would like to do in and through you? If your marriage is all about you, you are in for a long marriage and not in a great way. Your marriage is about what is God doing in and through you? And they're getting this in a very sweet picture, and Boaz is as well. But I'll have to leave you with a cliffhanger for tonight because I got to let you go. It says, now it is true, I am a close relative. Ruth's like, yes! However, there is a relative closer than I. He says, look, I'd love to do this, but the law demands that I have to do something else. So remain this night. We'll pick this up next week. Remain here. He's going to bless her, send her home. We'll see what Naomi does with that. But you guys, here, let me end this way. Don't pack everything up yet. So even here, although Boaz longs to be a redeemer, he longs to make this provision, he knows that he has to do this rightfully and lawfully. Imagine the foolishness of thinking that there's some kind of sexual escapades going on here, everybody being ungodly, because it, certainly, according to the word of God, adultery, fornication, or evil in the extreme. And he's calling her, blessed are you of the Lord. She's saying, you know, cover me as the Lord would cover me. All of these really beautiful, deep spiritual things, and somehow all this is just a cover for some kind of sexual game. It's ridiculous. Okay, so just read the text, and that will help you. You'll do better than most commentators if you'll just read what's going on in the text and say, all this is pure and holy, the purpose of what they're pointing to is good and right, and yet even here, Boaz says, I'd love to make that provision, but there's something I got to do. This has to be done lawfully, so you're going to have to wait. Let me do that. even though I long to get this done. And one final thing I'd ask you, young men. I know I'm making applications because this is an historical narrative that you can't flesh out, and I don't want you to. But I do want you to ask you this question. Are you willing to do whatever it takes before you would enter into a relationship to take care of things biblically and spiritually? Not skipping steps. I'll do this. I want to get you for this reason. I'll skip this thing so I can get you. I want you quick. So, you know, I've got to get you for myself. I've got to carve out, you know, I've got to get rid of any of the competitors. So I'll manipulate and I'll gossip so I can get you just to me. All those things that young men do to somehow get a relationship. Will you just take the time to do the steps right and trust that God will do what is right and best? Boaz has every chance of losing Ruth here. In fact, we'll see if you read ahead in the story that again, that's what's going to happen. Who wouldn't want a Naomi's land? Right? Who wouldn't want to have that rich benefit? He's got very little chance here, and I think in his mind, he knows that. He could lose this whole deal, but it doesn't matter. What's first and foremost is what the Lord wants. Don't skip steps in holiness, in spirituality. And again, I'm not saying you got to wait till you're 50. Okay, young men, 19, 20. I've seen strong, deep. And why do you need to be 25? Why aren't you being ready now? And again, many of you are, so don't hear that I'm making fun of you. I'm not. Many of you are making this kind of preparation. And I'm saying you got to get married when you're 19 or 20. Some you ought to wait sometimes. But I'm saying you ought to be prepared. And you don't skip steps. So you can walk forward in the kind of relationship that will be honoring to the Lord. Let's pray. Father, thank you for our time. Thank you for the just privilege of being here with this group of young people. And I pray, Lord, that even past my ability to communicate, that you would be working in their hearts to see the beauty of this relationship that you are laying out in Scripture. And that they would see through that and in that the beautiful picture of your relationship with us. Your holiness and righteousness credited to our account and your work on our behalf, even though we are failing and sinful. And when I pray for my young men and young women, that they would choose to be godly and holy, that they would choose to pursue relationships for the blessing and benefit, not only of themselves spiritually, but for others, and that would set the tone for their relationships even now in this group, and that they would be wise, not skipping past steps of holiness and righteousness to just get what they want. And in doing so, that they would be such a blessing to their parents, such a blessing to this church, and that we would watch numerous godly relationships flourish in this church as a result of godly behavior. In your precious name, Lord Jesus, amen.